You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 12th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio 2 in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, just over 6 years since the murder of Novaya Gazeta reporter Anna Politkovskaya focused global attention on the lethal risks of journalism in Russia, another trial of her suspected killers gets underway. We'll ask, will we ever know what really happened? Egyptians are due to vote this weekend on a new draft constitution, but some are voting already. We'll meet those queuing to decide their country's future at their embassy in London.
I'm agreeing. I want the country to go on along. We can't stop. And this can be altered later if you want. This is the proper move to Egypt.
We'll also have the latest from Cairo. Elsewhere, we'll catch up on technology news with David Phelan. Today, gadgets to help you sleep, and we don't mean J.R.R. Tolkien e-books, and cameras with Wi-Fi.
It has a very cool thing that it monitors your sleep very carefully. It can tell from your movement while you're asleep how deeply asleep you are. And the idea is that it wakes you up in a very refreshed state.
We'll be asking why James Harding, well-liked editor of The Times, has resigned. And we'll be joined in the studio by Magnum photographer Peter Marlowe and author and gin expert Richard Barnett. All that and more ahead in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Chinese television has broadcast interviews with North Korean residents who said they were proud and excited about their nation's successful rocket launch, which happened earlier today. It is North Korea's second launch this year. Leaders around the world condemned the move, including Russia and the British Foreign Secretary William Hague.
The United Kingdom condemns this launch. It is a breach of UN Security Council resolutions 1718 and 1874 because it involves the use of ballistic missile technology. So we are summoning the North Korean ambassador. We're consulting with our partners in the UN Security Council about next steps. And we look to the DPRK to avoid further provocative actions and try to build peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula.
The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has just sentenced the Bosnian Serb general Zdravko Tolomir to life in prison for his role in the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, Europe's worst atrocity since World War II. Judges said he oversaw the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys after the town was overrun in July 1995. European Union finance ministers are today trying to agree on a banking union for the 27-member bloc. The Irish finance minister, Michael Noonan, was hopeful the meeting would be a success.
And just as we came in, we got a text to say that there was a French-German compromise paper circulated. So on the basis of that, it looks as if there's at least the basis for an agreement there now. It'll be a long meeting, though, I'm sure, because there are lots of issues, but I'd be hopeful.
Germany's cabinet has today approved a draft law protecting the right to circumcise infant boys, which it says will end months of legal uncertainty after a local court banned the practice, saying it constituted bodily harm, causing outrage among Muslims and Jews. The speed with which national lawmakers agreed to draw up a new law underscores sensitivity to charges of intolerance in a country haunted by its Nazi past. The former president, Nelson Mandela, is continuing to recover from a lung infection that has put the 94-year-old anti-apartheid leader in hospital for the last 5 days. South Africa's first black president remains a hero to its 52 million people and to tourists who were thinking of him today.
His strength, his philosophy, his love, his power for his people, I don't think any other president.
And I hope he soon recovers. Yes. And is back in public life.
What he did, it's inspired for everybody.
And finally, after weeks of anticipation that bordered on media frenzy, Pope Benedict solemnly put his finger to a tablet today and sent his first tweet. The message was sent at the end of his weekly general audience in the Vatican in front of thousands of people. The senior Vatican communications advisor, Greg Burke, was delighted.
You know, we're really delighted with the way things have happened because the Pope reached 1 million followers right before his very first tweet. And the very first tweet, of course, was just really welcome. I'm glad to be here with all of you. So sort of an introduction. And now during the day, there are going to be the questions and answers about faith.
That's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
And who'd have guessed he was such a big Justin Bieber fan? Thank you, Jonathan. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot Londo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio 2 in London with me, Andrew Muller. On October 7th, 2006, Anna Politkovskaya, a journalist with Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, was found shot dead in a lift in the Moscow apartment block where she lived. Politkovskaya was far from the first or last Russian journalist to have died in suspicious circumstances during the ascendancy of Vladimir Putin, but her death became emblematic of the lethal dangers of reporting authority, much less questioning it, in post-Soviet Russia. Endeavours to call anyone to account for Politkovskaya's murder have lurched somewhere between the half-hearted and the farcical. Three Chechen men were tried and acquitted in 2009 before a retrial was ordered by Russia's Supreme Court. And today in Moscow, a former policeman, Dmitry Palyachenkov, went on trial accused of organising the hit. Well, joining us now to wonder if justice will ever be done, and if so, what sort of justice, is Ben Judah, policy associate at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Ben, why did this one death of this one journalist become such a focus? As I was saying, and as I'm sure you know, literally hundreds of Russian journalists have died in the last couple of decades.
Well, when Putin came to power, he was greeted by a lot of Russian liberals as a necessary symbol of re-centralization after the chaos of the 90s. And it took several years for people to realize that Putin wasn't a kind of tough liberal, but was actually, you could say, a soft authoritarian.
I mean, is her relative posthumous celebrity the only reason that any efforts at all have been made to bring someone to account?
Well, sadly, she's a posthumous celebrity here, but not in Russia. And her name is synonymous with the failure of Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's kind of marionette president, who said during his so-called term that her killers would be brought to justice, and he listed this as one of his priorities.
And what do we know about Dmitry Palyachenkov, the former police officer who stood whose trial began, I should say, today in Moscow?
Well, what we know is that he's a former police officer with kind of dubious connections, and that the psychiatrists who have been observing this trial think that he's come to conclusions based purely on his own imagination. He's not a kind of credible source. And Politkovskaya's family are extremely concerned and angry that he's being given a kind of special trial, a reduced jail term, even though he's suggested that Politkovskaya's killers are actually Putin's main foe from the early 2000s, Boris Berezovsky, which is very unlikely.
Are we being invited to believe that the buck stopped with Dmitry Palyachenkov, or is it likely that he was working on behalf of somebody else, if indeed he was involved at all?
Well, everything in Russia is seen either as a conspiracy or as evidence of incompetence. And this affair and this trial, like everything else, a blend of both.
The proverbial riddle trapped inside an enigma.
Well, it's a kind of conspiracy trapped inside an act of incompetence. So it's a very badly organised affair. There are all kinds of strange sort of conspiracies going on within it. The big question is that whether or not we see this as evidence of Putin's strength, that Putin could ask for this and could keep all this evidence secret, or actually Putin's weakness is that some middle-level official or some Chechen official could order this hit, humiliate Putin, and he'd be forced into this very embarrassing process of protecting an official and look like he ordered the murder.
Well, I guess this is one of the key questions surrounding this case and all similar cases of violent death being meted out to reporters in Russia, whether there is some great program of elimination being ordered from somewhere near the top of Russian politics, or whether there's just a general atmosphere in which people who may be annoyed with one journalist or another understand that it's, you know, it's fair game.
Well, the key fact is that more journalists were murdered under Yeltsin than had been murdered under Putin. And in the early 90s, you had around 12, 15 journalists being killed a year. This year, only one person was murdered. And he was actually working for a state TV channel. He wasn't an investigator. He was a kind of pro-government pundit. And he was killed in the North Caucasus, likely by religious extremists. So Putin says that he's actually got the situation under control.
But how dangerous is being a reporter in Russia now? You say only one death so far this year, but it's still, it's not the easiest beat to patrol.
It's not the easiest beat to patrol. It's difficult. You get threatened. Journalists from Novaya Gazeta receive calls from the FSB and from the authorities, sometimes even death threats. But it's worth remembering that much more journalists are imprisoned in Erdogan's Turkey than in Putin's Russia.
Yeah, we covered this last night on the Monocle Daily. Turkey is now the world leader in imprisoning journalists. But in Russia in particular, are there what are the particular areas, I guess, which are dangerous places for reporters to tread?
It's not really areas, it's more level of rank. So people who've exposed Putin's personal corruption, Putin has been implicated with documents that have been released by whistleblowers, being involved in a scheme stealing money from a charitable organisation with donations to help buy medical equipment. This guy's fine. It's the mid-level people that are very murderous. It's governors, it's heads of police departments. It's a kind of predatory bureaucracy that, because they know that Putin needs them, acts with impunity.
How does this tend to play with the Russian public? I mean, I'm sure it's as true in Russia as it is everywhere else that journalists and politicians rank somewhere near the lowest levels of public esteem. But I think there's an acceptance in most of the West that the press is, to an extent, sacrosanct. Does that hold true in Russia?
Well, it's changing. And journalism in the 1990s, it was seen as a hacks game. All of the reporters were seen as basically kind of guns for hire and all working on the orders of oligarchs. And the press, when it covered the first Chechen War, was quite unprofessional. People were either viciously pro-government or viciously pro-Chechen. And in the early part of Putin's rule, journalists were not seen as the people's friend. But this has changed, and a new generation of Russian journalists has been really important in leading the protest movement and are seen as the hippest people in Moscow. And their slogan is that journalism is an act of citizenship.
Well, it's an encouraging thought, and it'd be nice to see it catch on. But just finally, and relatively briefly if possible, what do you think is the chance that we will ever know what really happened to Anna Politkovskaya and why?
We'll know for sure when the Putin era is over. The question is whether it will be over anytime soon.
Ben Judah, Policy Associate at the European Council on Foreign Relations, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Well, Egypt's nascent democracy is due to take a large step sideways this weekend as Egyptians are asked to vote on a new draft constitution. Both the constitution and the poll itself are controversial. Opponents of President Mohamed Morsi have called for the referendum to be scrapped, and as many as 90% of Egypt's judges are believed to be refusing to take up their supervisory role. However, some Egyptians overseas have already started voting. Shortly, we'll be hearing from Cairo-based journalist Abdulrahman Hussein, but first we sent Monocle's Haley Joel Ott to chat with some London-based Egyptians queuing outside their embassy about their thoughts prior to voting.
I'm agreeing. I want the country to go on along. We can't stop. And this can be altered later if you want. This is the proper move to Egypt, honestly. If so, no, they will have to go back 8 months, cancelling the committee, the constitution committee, and start all over again. The economics of the country will not stand that sort of dragging slowly along the process. We cannot stand this. We should get on with the job, in my opinion. And if you don't like it in 4 years, change it.
I thought no, because we don't really need that, you know, what he's putting Egypt down, I'll be honest with you. He's putting the whole country down, and we're not going to allow him to do that. If it's passed, the people stay in Tahrir Square, and we still say no. So no is no. He should listen to us because we vote for him. He should listen to us. We don't want dictator to be another dictator to come.
I voted for the new constitution, accepting, because I think it is a very crucial stage in Egyptian history after the 25th of January revolution, which need the country affairs to go in a much smoother way and to try to play down the political differences between the different parties in Egypt. Democracy is considered new to the Egyptian people.
I voted no for this new discourse because it's not for everyone in Egypt. It's for just a group of people in Egypt. They do it for themselves. And it's not for everyone, and that's not right. And a lot of people go out to protest outside in the street. Not thousand, it's a million people everywhere in the country. And they don't want to listen. Okay, we voted no. We don't want this sort to be ours. I think if they don't do anything dodgy, it's not going to pass. Because more than 90% of the people, they doesn't want this disturb. Just the Islamic people, they want this disturb. Because they write it down, they find it good. But for me, no. And for 90%, the people die in the street to stop this disturb. We shouldn't vote for them, yes. For something, people die for it.
I voted to support the president at the moment, but because what I feel is that we need to move forward, whether everybody is with or against, he needs to, you know, say his views without any demonstration or anything. I think we moved a very, very, very big step during the last couple of years from a lot of corruption to we are moving towards stability. This is the main issue that Egypt is needing for now, right now. There are lots of issues to be addressed here, so I might say that it will pass narrowly, if it will pass, but I hope it will pass.
And that was Haley Joel Ott talking to Egyptian voters in London. But from Egypt now, I'm joined by Cairo-based reporter Abdulrahman Hussein. Abdul, good afternoon or good evening where you are.
Good evening.
What's the mood like in Cairo now?
It's still polarized. It's still divided. Nobody really knows where this... We keep hearing conflicting news and conflicting things about what's going to happen, whether this referendum is happening, it's not happening. It's been staggered over 2 days of voting as opposed to one. And so there's a lot of confusion at the moment, and it's just, it's not the most ideal situation going into a vote such as this. that will determine Egypt's future.
And what do you think the mood's likely to be after prayers on Friday?
I think there'll be protests, but the main opposition bloc, the National Salvation Front, will make their final decision on Friday about whether to announce a boycott or campaign or mobilize for a no vote. I think they're more inclined to mobilize for a no vote at this point, but they're going to wait and see and give the final decision on Friday. But I think definitely protests will be happening on Friday.
That's leaving it a bit late to make a decision like that, isn't it?
It's leaving it a bit late because it's dependent on whether there'll be enough judicial supervision over the ballot boxes or not. They feel that if there isn't enough judicial supervision on the ballot boxes, then that would render the entire process illegitimate.
And as far as anyone can tell, what is the latest from the judges? Are they going to turn out or not?
Well, I think the High Elections Commission that is overseeing the referendum says that it has enough judges to oversee the process, but that would mean that there would be one judge for every three ballot boxes, which might not go down well with the opposition. But they seem confident that they have enough judges, and I think the fact that they staggered the vote over 2 days is to make up for the shortage of judges overseeing the process.
Are there any signs of compromise from Mohamed Morsi, who would obviously prefer to proceed with a constitution that looks like it has a mandate from Egypt's people?
Compromise prior to the referendum? I don't think so. I think he's counting on this referendum passing, and that will be his, so to speak, his mandate, a renewal of his mandate if it passes.
Abdul, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as the vote draws near and indeed shortly after it. Abdul Rahman Hussein in Cairo, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. This is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. But on Wednesdays on Monocle 24's midday show, The Briefing, we review the week's top stories in the world of technology. Well, today, Louise Beale caught up with our regular tech contributor, David Phelan. They chatted about a new compact camera with Wi-Fi and 3G, and anticipating the ungodly amounts of weight most of us will put on over the holidays, they considered fitness gadgets.
Let's start off by something, well, quite exciting, and you've bought in one, but the Samsung Galaxy camera. Just tell us a bit about this. This is sort of combining phone technology and a camera.
Yes, exactly. Compact cameras are really, people are not buying them anymore because the camera you really use is the one that's in your pocket all the time, which is always your mobile phone.
Exactly.
And although they don't match a compact for image quality, they're good enough. People are prepared to compromise because it's convenient and because you can upload pictures to Facebook and Twitter very, very easily. So there are certain things that a phone camera will never match. It can't have an optical zoom. There was one, but it was just way too chunky for use. And it can't have a very big sensor because a slim camera means that you can't have the distance between the sensor and the lens has to be a certain size to work.
Okay.
So this is essentially a Samsung Galaxy S3, their very popular smartphone, built into a camera with an optical 21x zoom and a big screen and full mobile phone capabilities apart from calls. You can't make calls on it.
And, right, OK, I was going to say, because you look a bit funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Because just to describe it now to people listening, I mean, it's like a small camera, but it's much thinner, really, isn't it? I mean,
yes, it's like a thick camera phone or a thin camera,
right, yeah.
And the retractable lens shoots out as soon as you switch it on. But if you look at it from the other side, it could easily be just a regular smartphone, and indeed you can play Angry Birds on it and do all the other things that you can
Thank
do.
Thank heavens.
I know. Although that does deplete the battery, and it might do it just at that moment when you need to take a photograph.
I was saying to you before we came on, but I'm not sort of surprised that this is happening because, as you said, people tend to, me included, you go somewhere, you forget your camera because you don't carry it around necessarily as part of an everyday thing, but you go somewhere and you want to take a photo and you get out your smartphone and you can take
one.
Do you think that we'll see things getting any thinner than that, or having a phone literally that will have that camera attached to it as well? Is that where it's going? Or, as you were just describing, is the technology not able to do that?
Well, there is another way to do it. Nokia has done this with a 42 megapixel camera phone, but that's very chunky as well, and people really want something slim in their pocket. So I don't think for the foreseeable future, they can really combine the two perfectly. But this is only Samsung's first attempt. But it has Wi-Fi and it has a SIM card slot, so you can upload your pictures just as easily as you could.
And as you say, it does look like a smartphone on one side, but also if you're on the phone on that, you would look a bit strange.
Yes.
Let's talk now about fitness gadgets. This is a bit terrifying that this is happening already, but getting ready for the new year.
Yes.
A lot more fitness gadgets coming on the market, some pretty, pretty interesting ones.
I don't want to wish away your Christmas, but certainly they're already coming on to the market. I've talked about the Fitbit before now. This is the latest model of the Fitbit, and it's a tiny little glossy black gadget that clips onto your belt or your pocket, and each time you press a button, the screen changes and it tells you how many steps you've taken, how many calories you've burned, and so on. And you can even wear it on your wrist at night and it'll wake you up by vibrating. And that's just out. That's the Fitbit One. But the Jawbone Up, which is something, again, I've talked about a year ago when it first came out, it had to be withdrawn from the market because it wasn't quite waterproof, as they had said it would be. But it's coming back in the spring. It's just come out again in the States, but in the UK it'll be out in January, February. And that does all the same things. It doesn't have a screen. You have to look on your iPhone to see how well you're doing in terms of your activity. But it has a very cool thing that it monitors your sleep very carefully. It can tell from your movement while you're asleep how deeply asleep you are, if you're deep asleep or lightly asleep.
Now,
the best time to wake up is when you're moving from deep to light asleep. So once you've set an alarm, it starts monitoring your movements. And in the half hour before that alarm time, it spots when you've gone from deep sleep to light sleep. And that's when it vibrates. And the idea is that it wakes you up in a very refreshed state. And
that's incredible.
Yes, and when it works, it's brilliant. I mean, it always does. When I've used it, it always has woken me up. The truth is, I've always been in a lighter state of sleep too early, so it's just woken me up half an hour before.
Which actually makes you feel less fresh and more slightly annoyed.
Yes, there was a bit of that. But it was very reliable, and I think the newer version now has an extra, a power nap setting.
And that was David Phelan and Louise Beale discussing the week's top tech stories. It's time now for a song from Italy. This is De Estate with, and you'll see what we've done here, Fitness Forever. That was D'Estate back announcing themselves there with Fitness Forever. In the next half hour of the program, we'll meet Magnum photographer Peter Marlowe and the author Richard Barnett. We'll also have the latest on the resignation of Times editor James Harding. But before all of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Chinese television has broadcast interviews with North Korean residents who said they were very excited about their nation's successful rocket launch, which happened earlier today. It's North Korea's second launch this year. Leaders around the world condemned the move, including Russia. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia has just sentenced the Bosnian Serb general Zdravko Tolimer to life in prison for his role in the 1995 Srebrenica massacre, Europe's worst atrocity since World War II. European Union finance ministers are trying to agree on a banking union for the 27-member bloc as they met in Brussels today. Germany's cabinet has today approved a draft law protecting the right to circumcise infant boys, which it says will end months of legal uncertainty after a local court banned the practice, saying it constituted bodily harm, causing outrage among Muslims and Jews. And South Africa's former president Nelson Mandela is continuing to recover from a lung infection that has put the 94-year-old anti-apartheid leader in hospital for the past 5 days. That's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you. And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio 2 here in London with me, Andrew Muller. The latest publication to be issued by legendary photojournalists cooperative Magnum is entitled Magnum Revolution. It's a collection of images of insurrection, rebellion and sundry tumult from the 1956 Hungarian uprising to the ongoing Arab Spring. And joining me now is Peter Marlowe, who has been with Magnum for more than 30 years and has the cabinet full of trophies to prove it. His work is represented in Magnum Revolution by a shot of child soldiers in Zimbabwe. Welcome, Peter.
Hi, very nice to see you.
First of all, I wanted to talk about that picture of yours, because as an occasional print reporter, I'm always interested in the stories behind the photographs. How did that one come to be taken?
Well, there's a very long story behind that particular story, in that I was, I was a young photographer in the mid-70s and quite politically engaged. And I got involved with the leader of one of the two halves of the Patriotic Front, Joshua Nkomo. Funnily enough, I met him at the Savoy Hotel. And I persuaded him that I needed to go there and show them how to take pictures. So I took a suitcase darkroom with me, which they incidentally did pay for, and set up a darkroom in Lusaka, where they were based, and taught some of the comrades, as it were, to take pictures.
Now, you felt that they needed to learn how to take pictures because you were trying to explain to them that pictures do have a political impact, which I guess is what this book very much demonstrates.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, the honest answer to that. I was trying to, I knew that there was certainly Ian Smith at the time didn't realise the number of people that were on the other side of the border trying to liberate what they saw as their own country. And so it was a kind of way of giving something back, because I knew that by doing that, that was the only way I was ever going to get the access to the things I wanted to see.
There's a half century of revolutions and rebellions and uprisings chronicled in this book. It struck me leafing through it and having seen a few such events up close myself that there is kind of a limited repertoire of visuals to these things. It seems they're quite similar looking events, revolutions. There's sort of people standing on barricades and waving flags. Do you think they have kind of the photography of revolutions has developed, I guess, a template which subsequent revolutions feel they need to adhere to?
Maybe. I mean, there's been a tradition, hasn't there, recently, of having a colour for your revolution.
Yeah. You know,
the Green Revolution, the Orange Revolution. But I think to describe revolution as a bit of a cliche is that's a bit extreme. But, you know, I do appreciate your point. I think that, you know, if you look at some of our photographers are in it, but the Times Lens blog this week, showing pictures from Syria. I mean, it almost brought me to tears. I mean, it's, you know, you may take the same picture or the same sort of, you know, compositionally similar picture, but I mean, it's the message that's important, not the way of delivering it.
I mean, I know from having worked with a lot of photographers that all photographers are different, but when you are in the thick of it, when you are it, because these are still moments from extremely fluid, fast-moving events in this book, Are you thinking while you're looking around, or is it instinctive? Is there something you're looking for when you're holding your camera up to this stuff?
I think it depends on the photographer. I mean, it's, you know, I think I really don't do any of that stuff anymore. I do it in a sort of slightly different way. Is you have to think about what is going to work in a magazine. So you've got to tell the story. So it requires a little bit of intelligence. Or then there's the other photographers who are completely intuitive and just, you know, just, well, hate to use the word, but click away. And somehow the personality and the way of communicating comes across. I mean, you've got to remember that for some of these photographers, it was very personal. Joseph Kudelka in Prague, 1968, you know, Soviet Union had invaded his country. Abbas, during the Iranian Revolution, you know, he watched the extremists take over.
I mean, how, and also when you are in the thick of those moments, how able are you to judge the risk to yourself of what you're doing? Obviously, there are some photographers whose work is represented in this book who have been injured or killed in the line of duty, up to probably the most recent one, Tim Hetherington, who died in Misrata last year. Are you able to make that calculation at the time as well or not?
I think when I was doing it, which was a good while ago, I think I was just, you don't really think too much about that. Although as soon as I got into dangerous situations, happened to me once in when the Israelis pulled out the Sinai, when, you know, we were under fire, and it made me realize, you know, I had a family and this is not the thing to do when you've got people dependent on you. So, but I think, you know, everybody makes their own call, really. And I decided that it wasn't really for me to continue. So,
because this is always something I've been aware of in similar situations myself, that if you're a writer, you can, to an extent, find stories behind the lines. But photographers either have the shot or they don't have it. They need to stay with the story.
That's right. You've really got to be. You have to be there to get the picture. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I mean, there's plenty of writers who've written the story from a hotel room or by the side of a swimming pool. I've seen it myself.
Covering it from Mahogany Ridge, as it's known in the trade. One of the things that has changed in photography over the half century or so that this book chronicles is the technology of photography. The phrase that the camera never lies doesn't have quite the same truth that it once did, because cameras can be made to lie very easily now. Do you think that the ease with which photos can now be manipulated has caused people to trust them less, or lessened their impact, if you like?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, we've got to look at the way the news is transmitted now. It's, you know, people journalists. It's somebody with a camera phone. It's, you know, it's changed. I mean, and Magnum's got to respond to that somehow. You know, the jury's out in a way about what it's going to mean for us.
You spoke a few minutes ago there about the personal impact that some photos you'd seen from the current fighting in Syria had on you. Do you think there are still things that, despite the advances in technology and the advances in communication, are there still things that a still photo can do that no other form of news reportage can?
That's a pretty tricky question, yeah. I mean, I looked at those pictures. It came as it was a newsletter from Magnum, and it, you know, pointed out that these pictures were up on the Time blog. I looked at them, and I mean, I was absolutely gutted when I saw them, because they were just so incredibly powerful. And the sort of personal tragedy of a kid having his father blown away, you know, trying to pick up the pieces. It was just so powerful. And I think, well, that's what photography can do. I think film writing does it in a different way, but we occupy a space that is still very powerful.
It's that sudden impact, isn't it? It's the way, and this is the thing I've always been quite jealous of as a writer, that sort of what the same impact I might toil for 3,000 or 4,000 words to get across, a good photographer can just smack people straight between the eyes with one image.
True to a certain extent, but it does require a lot of work to get to that point. I mean, my wife always says, you expect everything to happen because everything in your life happens when you press the button. So you expect everything to happen so quickly, you got no patience. I think that's probably true for a lot of photographers.
Peter Marlowe, whose work features in the new book Magnum Revolution, 65 Years of Fighting for Freedom. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House.
This Christmas, Monocle 24 is packing its earmuffs, mittens, sticks and skis as we head up the Alps to sunny St. Moritz for a winter retreat. We'll be bringing you a Christmas stocking full of shows, including The Briefing, Midori House and The Review. So join our editors and their guests for a festive spree of friends and family, debate and discussion, with plenty of mulled wine. From Boxing Day all the way to New Year's Day 2013, right here on Monocle 24.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick and span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero emission zealots. a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1842 here in London. An ancient snippet of journalistic wisdom holds that you should never work for a liberal newspaper. They'll sack you on Christmas Eve. However, it appears that it might be time to extend that law to cover centre-right newspapers. James Harding, editor of The Times, has resigned after 5 years in the job, intriguingly claiming that it had been made clear to him that News Corporation were looking to replace him. The likeliest candidate, at least in the short term, appears to be Sunday Times. Times editor John Witherow. It's the latest ruction in a rickety year for Times publisher News International and its parent company News Corporation, which is at the centre of the still unfolding scandal over phone hacking that led to the recently concluded Leveson inquiry into media ethics. Well, joining me now to figure out what this means is media commentator Arian McNichol. Arian, Harding seems to have suggested in his farewell peroration that he's jumping before he's pushed. Does that seem fair?
It's interesting. This whole business has come as both a surprise and really not that much of a surprise. I would say he is being pretty straight up when he says that he is jumping before he was pushed. But as you intimated in that introduction, it looks as though the most likely candidate to take the job will be the Sunday Times editor, John Witherow, and what this is all part of. At least, you know, the way it looks from the outside is that this is a moment where News International is beginning to bring together both the Times and the Sunday Times under one umbrella. And so, in a sense, it's not actually that surprising. It's surprising because James Harding has been an exceptional editor, and I actually was working at the Times and was lucky enough to work with him quite early on after he was appointed in 2007. But you know, he had a very, very good reputation for the entire time that he was editing the Times. And so in that sense, I suppose it is surprising. But, you know, we have seen some fairly significant changes right at the top of News International, including now Tom Mockridge, who is also going to be leaving the post of CEO of News International, and more broadly, this fits into the context of the entire restructure that Murdoch is undertaking in separating off his major publications from the entertainment products under the new name of Fox. So really, we're seeing a great number of changes, and this could be seen in the context of that as being part of those shifts.
Arian, I'll come back to the shuffling of the deck chairs in the big office shortly, but I did want to pick up on that point of how well or otherwise he's done as editor of the Times. As you say, he's clearly very well liked. He is indeed one of those people that you rarely hear an unkind word said about, which isn't that common in newspaper editors. And it also, it's notable that the online response of his of Times staff to his departure does seem genuinely grief-stricken. But the fact is that circulation has gone down 40% on his watch. Is that his fault, though?
I think that the industry is, as we all know, in some fairly significant trouble, and I can't see that it necessarily was his problem. The reality of how he approached his editorship was to really try to maintain and even bring back some of the old, really sort of substantial and significant attitudes of what the Times was and has always been. And I think, you know, the seriousness of his Times was underlined by the fact that he put his leaders on page two, really giving the leaders that prominence that they hadn't had for a long time. And under his predecessor, Robert Thompson, the paper had been accused of being comparatively tabloidy. And so he really tried to make it a much more serious publication as it had always been in the past. So perhaps you could look at that as being related to its drop in circulation, but I think actually that's more to do with the state of the industry in general.
Well, also on Harding's watch, the Times did become the first quality paper in Britain, certainly to institute a paywall in 2010, which is to say they stopped giving their product away online. How has that gone?
Well, it was very controversial at the time, and when it was first floated that the Times would be going behind a paywall, I think that there was genuine antipathy towards that move from the rest of the industry. And the idea was that at this stage in history, the internet was a place where information should be free. So it really flew in the face of the prevailing wisdom of the time. As it turns out, the Times and the Sunday Times have managed to attract 110,000 subscribers over the last year and a bit. And so in actual fact, it's been seen as something of a success. Even so, they haven't necessarily started to rake in the cash. So we're not looking at a digital solution, which I think that a lot of the other major publishers were hoping might be something that would be found. But if you look across the industry, many other newspapers that previously thought that it was a bad idea, for example, the New York Times, have now instituted a paywall of their own. So actually, James Harding could be seen to be quite ahead of the curve in that decision. And I think history will show that even if it doesn't work absolutely, it was the right thing at that moment in time.
Arian McNichol, thank you very much for joining us. That's media analyst Arian McNichol on the departure of James Harding from The Times here in London. You're listening to Midori House. And because we'll shortly be meeting the author of a book about gin, this is the Third Coast Kings with Tonic Stride. That was Third Coast Kings with Tonic Stride, which we have played for reasons which will presently become clear as sort of a cue to our next item, which is in honour of the fact that people have been drinking gin since the Middle Ages. And despite the fact that people have been drinking gin since the Middle Ages, the drink struggles like few other spirits for a sympathetic press. Gin is often associated with slatternly proletarian decadence. Not for nothing did William Hogarth call his famous portrait of the depravities of 18th century London Gin Lane. Or it's written off as the furtive tranquilizer of depressed housewives, the so-called Mother's Ruin. Or it's stereotyped as the preferred quaff of red-nosed Jaguar-driving boars swigged in between rounds of golf and UKIP meetings. Well, one man who has doubtless heard and shrugged off every condemnation of the juniper juice is Richard Barnett, author of The Book of Gin, who joins me in the studio now. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, of all the drinks in all the towns in all the world to write a book about, you chose gin. Why?
Well, I'm actually a historian of science and medicine by background, and it turned out that gin had the most wonderful sort of prehistory and a kind of global history. Following the history of gin was following in the footsteps of all kinds of explorers, scientists, doctors, many of whom had, as you say, not taken a very positive view of this drink. But it was a wonderful chance to tell a different kind of global history in what I hope is a sort of readable and enjoyable kind of way.
So why do you think gin has been stereotyped in all sorts of ways in a way that vodka and whiskey tend not to get so much?
I think the first thing to say is, as I say, it's had this very long global history. Almost wherever people have been in the last 500 years, they've taken gin in some kind of form with them, or when they've got there, they've made a version of gin out of whatever they've got to hand. If you look at the very first incarnation of gin, Geneva, being drunk and made in the Dutch Republic in the 16th, 17th centuries, it's really an embodiment of everything the West knows about Sorry, forgive me. It's really an embodiment of everything that the West sort of knows about the world at the time. You've got it flavoured with slave sugar from British plantations in the Caribbean. You've got herbs and spices being brought in from the East Indies. You've got Baltic grain being used to make it. And you've got good old juniper, which grows all over Europe. So it really is a kind of global spirit in that sort of way.
How vast is the difference in tastes and textures of gin around the world?
It's enormous. You get very different kinds of gin. The main thing to say is, I guess, about the sweetness. Here in London, we're very used to a very dry kind of gin. In fact, that called London dry gin. If you go to Holland, you'll find a more traditional kind of Genever, very, very sweet indeed. And if you go to other places, Portugal, for example, they have versions of it which are aged in barrels and, in fact, very sort of dark. And you can see this variation over the history of gin as well. If you look at the very first sort of proto-gins that are being made in Europe in the 11th century, they're really little more than crushed juniper berries distilled with wine. So you get something that's really fiery. Not something you would want to drink for pleasure. If you've ever popped a juniper berry in your mouth, you'll know all about that. Then if you go through to, as you said, the time of William Hogarth, the gin craze, gin that you're buying on the street in London is distilled from rotting fruit that you might find at Covent Garden Market, and then it's flavoured with turpentine and even in some cases sulfuric acid. So what we call gin
delicious.
Has been exactly many things all over time and place.
Is gin just remarkably easy to manufacture? Because it was also the one of the signature drinks of bootleggers during the Prohibition era in the United States.
It's got a very simple, distinctive flavour, and that's juniper. Whiskey, for example, has this much more complicated flavour that has to develop over time, over being aged. Juniper grows most places across Western Europe, so it's easy to make. And it's also fatally easy to mimic that flavour with turpentine, which, again, is something you can make very, very easily. So I think the secret to gin success is that you can either produce it or mimic it in lots of different ways.
Near the end of your book, you rank an assortment of gins on what you call the Hogarth scale. To ask the inevitable question, do you have a particular favourite gin and a particular favourite way to drink it?
I should say that the Hogarth scale is not a scale of quality, it's a scale of flavour. A low score on the Hogarth scale is a kind of light, clean, fresh gin, and a high score is a sort of rich one. I didn't want to get into the messy business of trying to compare one with another. I wasn't a great gin drinker before. Sorry, I sound like I've been at it this afternoon, and I definitely haven't, I assure you. I wasn't a great gin drinker before I started writing the book, so it's been a wonderful journey of discovery into these different flavours. Probably if I was going to pick one, Tanqueray Rongpur is especially good. It's flavoured with lime. It's very, very good in a kind of summer martini. But if you want something for this time of year, there's a little distillery called Fox Denton. Actually, they don't distill, but they make gin, and they've got a wonderful slow gin, which is a very good thing for Christmas time. I think that's worth checking out.
And one of the fun things about writing any work of history is pulling on threads and seeing, you know, where they lead you. Was there any one thing you learnt about gin that surprised you?
Yes, the roots of gin, and indeed of all distilled spirits, go back to the Islamic Empire in the 8th and 9th centuries. That is not something you expect, perhaps, when you start making a journey into the history of an alcoholic beverage. But this comes out of this great flowering of scholarship in again, Baghdad, of all places, in the 7th and 8th and 9th centuries under the Abbasid Caliphate. Lots of alchemists, lots of writers. They're interested in the secret of the universe, just like the folk at CERN are today. And some of them think that if you distill things, you're concentrating their essence or their spirit. So a lot of these early Arabic scholars think that when they make their first little bottles of distilled spirit, they've somehow concentrated the life force of the universe. It's this idea of gin as the, or distilled spirit as the water of life, the kind of aqua vitae.
And it's my personal observation that large portions of the Middle East would do very well with a decent helping of it right now. Richard Barnett, author of The Book of Gin, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's edition. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Next up is Monocle 24's weekly business show, The Entrepreneurs, in which, among other things, we'll be finding out about a new personal assistant service in Cairo. 3 hours from now, at 2200 hours here in London, Tom Burgess Watson and Tig Enright will be back for the Monocle Daily, and Tom will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks very much for listening. Good evening.